Being a Feminist Killjoys, PhD, an hour of feminism, pop culture, and politics as discussed by two professional Killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today we'll be discussing cultural appropriation, blackfishing, whiteness, and theories on the social construction of race, and a whole bunch of other things via recent music videos and musical performances by Ariana Grande and J.Lo, respectively. But first, hello, Melody. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
What have you been up to?
What haven't I been up to, really? Well, today, this was a big weekend for me. I met Janice Shortall, who is a local TV news anchor, but I love her because she's queer as fuck and gender nonconforming and doesn't play by any of the traditional news media rules. And she's just like, not everybody loves her. Straight white dudes who have some problems with their masculinity and sexuality don't love her so much. But she gave a talk at this conference that I went to. I went to the student journalism conference over the weekend, and she just gave this like amazing, honest keynote speech about being who she is in the media world. And she was like really upfront about how often she's harassed online for having short hair and wearing ties. And she's like so attractive in so many ways, you know, like she's,
yeah,
it's and so I'll just say this one thing that came out of her talk was that she said she's often asked to talk about what makes her different than other news anchors, but she doesn't, like, she's getting tired of talking about it. Like, she wish it wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
Like, she's glad it's a thing, but she wished it wasn't a thing. And that was a good reminder for me that sometimes when people are different than others, like, not to, like, focus on that all the time.
Right, because she probably has smart things to say about things other than being gender nonconforming in the news.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Right, and her journalism is awesome. It's a little bit too emotional for my taste, but like, she does good work. Like, she does really, really good journalism and gets to know people on a level that other journalists don't. And so she gets upset about that because she's like, do you want to just call me out on like my journalism instead of my hair? Like, I'd rather get critiques for that than how I look. So that was cool.
That's rad.
Yeah. And I met her. So that was just
She is great. A babe.
Yeah, you can actually watch her stuff online. She hosts a show called Breaking the News, and it's later on in the evening, like about 6 or 6:30. And so it's like a different style of local news.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can see clips online if anybody wants to check her out.
Cool.
She's great. And then the other big thing that I did this week is I went to a workshop at the Women's Wood Shop that we interviewed.
Yeah,
fun. We interviewed Jess. Yeah, it was really cool. They had a doll horse making night. It's a Swedish doll that's made out of wood. And so we learned how to carve wood and like learned how to carve these horses, which was pretty fantastic.
That is so rad. So you have your own horse now?
Yeah, I'm not finished with it. I'm almost done like carving the wood and then I'm going to paint it.
That is so cool.
Yeah, that space is so cool. Like I really enjoyed every minute of the time that I was there.
That's so amazing. I love that you did that. It's on my list still. Cool.
So, very feministy week. How about you? How are you doing?
I am tired, but mostly good. Still having more days than not that I get weepy about our doggy. So still feeling heavy-hearted about the loss of our boy dog, but certainly moving forward and compartmentalizing also because I've had a lot to do. Last Sunday, I left for Washington State to go to Walla Walla, Whitman College specifically, where I was giving a workshop, a class guest lecture, and a talk on a roundtable discussion about gender, skin, and bodies. And I presented primarily work about the work I've done teaching yoga in prisons and jails. And then the workshop was also about kind of like just like public media in general. So I talked about freelance writing as well as our podcast, and people were excited to hear about the podcast stuff in particular. So shout out to any Whitman students that are listening and discovered us through that talk. And then I got in really late Wednesday night. Oh, and also shout out to Caitlin and Matt because they are our friends from grad school and they are the people who invited me, basically. Other people did too, but I think I have them to thank. And it was really, really good to see them. And then I got home super late Thursday night. I read tarot at Smitten Kitten, which is the feminist sex shop, sex toy store, sex education resource center thing here in Minnesota. And all the money that people paid went to St. Stephen's, which is a homeless shelter here. And we raised like hundreds of dollars. So that was really rad. I really loved reading people's cards. It was a fun but exhausting night. Reading tarot for other people is like it's energy work. And I was doing it like back to back to back to back. And I've been doing readings for other people for a while now, but I've never done like a public event like that without any breaks. And other tarot readers listening are probably like, yeah, duh, you can't do that. But now I know I can't do that. So that was draining. And then the next day, we went to Denver for sort of a, we want to get out of the house because we are so sad about the dog, / visit our friend Breck, / Valentine's Day week trip. And also flights to Denver are really cheap on Southwest from Minneapolis. So all of those things sort of worked together for us to decide to go there for the weekend. And it was a short trip, but a really good trip. The mountains are fucking beautiful. There was some really good vegan food. And it was just nice. So busy, but I am just so tired and ready to get back to like my routine. And I know you get like when you're thrown out of your surroundings and your routine and your work schedule, like, you know how like that can just make you feel like you're going out of your mind a little bit. So I'm like ready to get back to it.
What a week. Busy.
What a week. It was a week.
My goodness. Of yeah. Both successes of your academic and personal life and vacation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's a week. I'd be exhausted too.
It's good. Also, being busy is also good, though, because then your brain is like, It's hard to be sad when you're that busy, you know?
Yep.
I don't know. So, anyway. So, and some other stuff happened this week, too, that we want to talk about, because we have a 2-course meal at our dinner party tonight, and it's getting ruined.
Not just one bowl of gluten-free pasta. Right. We're going to have that and a salad.
Exactly. And they're both going to suck. They're getting ruined. Who's up first? What's our appetizer?
I think Ryan Adams is our appetizer. How do you feel? Okay, first off, let me just do a quick summary for people who don't know. And then the next question I need to ask is how you feel about it, because I'm not so connected to him. So at any rate, this is the deal. The New York Times put out an amazing piece of journalism, but it was also an expose into Ryan Adams. And he has a pattern of both with the people that he has married, such as Mandy Moore and his actual girlfriends, and also young women that he has recruited through the music scene. His behavior has been abusive. It's been manipulative. And basically what he does is he like gets these women under his control, promises them success in their career through him because he is a very big deal in the indie music scene in America, and then basically manipulates them into like not doing, like basically wants to sleep with them then. And then when they don't want to do that or when they get weird about it, he pulls the plug on anything related to music. And the abuse is horrible to begin with. But the other really sad pattern that was found in all the interviews that the New York Times did was that all of these women said that their relationship or interactions with him made them stop wanting to do music. And so like all of these women's music careers were like busted because of what he did to them. And I think that's just like super, super unfortunate, and also is a very, very good indicator for why we don't see more women in the music industry succeeding. It's just we haven't had the space or the respect given to let us talk about that. But that's like a fucking for real thing. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. But
yeah, great summary.
Okay.
I mean, I think
just
the one more sort of detail is that one of these women, when he first started sort of his sort of sexual flirtation / manipulation, she was only 15 when it started.
Yeah,
so
thank
that,
you. Yes.
That is also a really important part. How do I feel about it? I was like kind of shook up. I mean, I was definitely shook up by it the same way anybody is when we read sort of accounts of sexual abuse, particularly because I was super connected to his music, and it was a little bit, I was in bands in high school and college, and I never ever wanted to be a musician professionally. Like that was never my goal. So I didn't have the sort of same relationship to that aspect of it. And thankfully I didn't actually experience that in the music scene, but I just really, really hardcore related to just how intense it can be to be in relationships of any kind, I guess, but especially sort of things that are romantic in nature, sexual in nature, when they're so connected to music, because it's such an overwhelming feeling when you are young and making music that you love and surrounded by music that you love. It's almost like, this sounds like so fucking cliche and just cheesy, but it's kind of like the music itself is kind of like this drug that you're just like really, I don't know, it's just such like when it's good, it's this like magical, beautiful thing. And when I think about, I'm thinking about this a lot because I'm writing a lot about my life and my memoir when I was discovering like music genre, like community, and it's really intense. And so it just made me so sad to think about that feeling and how easy it would be to sort of get swept up in this person who had this power and who you admired, and then how just devastating it was to have that just so ruined. Yeah, so it's really heartbreaking. It makes me sad for these women and their careers. It's really not okay, you know, that it included a young girl. That's my sort of first reaction. What about you? You weren't into his music as much?
I was more of a Conor Oberst fan.
You can be both.
Who has also had his,
So you can be both. I was both.
I know, but I was really I didn't have any other space in my world. And he's had his own allegations, which I'm not into slandering people, but there's something, because we were both in the indie rock scene. Mm-hmm. I'm just not surprised. Like, it's sad, and I feel really bad for my friends who are huge Ryan Adams fans. And I wouldn't have maybe guessed that it would have been him, but at the same time, like, just kind of knowing how masculine-based the indie rock scene is, even though they had this, like, femmy kind of anti-masculine thing going on, it was still so dude-centric.
Totally.
I'm not surprised. Like, it's just, it's answering, for me, it's more like, oh, this is eye-opening. It's answering questions for me. It's giving me some context to why the scene was the way it was. And I don't for a second, let me rephrase it. As you were saying, it's just so fucked up because I can only imagine, like, how excited these women were to, like, work with Ryan Adams or, like, just to be noticed by him, you know, to be noticed by any of them. It would be a huge, huge deal. And for him to just, like, take advantage in such a gross way is just, it's just angering, and it just makes me so sad. And so, like I said earlier, my biggest takeaway is that it's just so, it just bums me out that all these women weren't able to see their careers through. And there's so many more that we just don't even know about.
Totally.
And it just gives me some answers to what's going on. And it helps in my classroom too when I'm like, well, but you got to remember, like, Harvey Weinstein and Ryan Adams, it's like, why do you think there's not more women involved, you know? Like, so it's just fucking sad. And
yeah, it is. And yeah, 100%. And I think that's a really good point to think about the sort of masculinity and how it's this, like, under the radar sort of, like, patriarchal sort of norms that are dressed up in, like, women's jeans from The Gap and, you know, love songs or whatever. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. The one last thing I'll say, because of course I'm gonna, like, killjoy the killjoying, is that I'm still not totally sold. I do think it was, you know, good journalism. I also am not totally sold that, like, these sort of exposés on individual men, for me, I'm still not totally sold on, like, all of the Me Too tactics that includes sort of, like, massive public shaming. And I know that's an unpopular opinion. We've talked about it on the show before. I know that I'm sort of a minority opinion in feminist circles about this, but, like, it individualizes a systemic problem. Like, they didn't talk about the thing that you just mentioned, like, sort of masculinity in indie rock, the indie rock scene. They talked about Ryan Adams as a bad man, like, a bad individual man. And, like, so here we can all, like, cancel Ryan Adams and you know, listen to Conor Oberst instead, even though he's probably done abusive shit too. So I'm still not, like, I don't love that. I don't know. So that's my note on that.
No, and I appreciate that point, especially because I think what's happening both in the movie industry and the music industry now is that, as you said, there's specific people that are bad. And then that the assumption then is like, well, if they haven't had an exposé done on them, basically, they're okay.
Exactly.
Right? When it's more of a systemic issue within an entire industry.
Totally.
And so that gets erased.
Yes.
So, yeah. And I did feel a little, like, weird reading the article. I was like, oh, my God, this is a lot of personal information about him.
Yeah.
I don't think I really need to know all of this.
Right, the text messages.
I get it. They did their job. Like, they did invest, because they were trying, they can't accuse him of doing these things without showing all of their evidence,
right, you know?
Well, maybe this is the question for you, and then we can move on. Like, knowing that all this stuff is happening, like, what would a better approach be from, like, a journalist or a media standpoint?
I don't know if I have the answer to that.
Okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Yeah, I was just curious, because I was just trying to see how...
I don't know that and again, this is, I'm incredibly unpopular. I don't think we need to publicly out abusers all the time. In all cases. And most people don't agree with me. I don't think that it's particularly in line with, like, transformative justice approaches, because I'm not crying for Ryan Adams because he has a shit ton of money and he's a white dude who's going to be just fine. I do think that that gets more complicated, and I've said this before on the show when we've talked about Me Too before. I do think it gets more complicated because it sets a precedent for, like, we need to publicly shame and ruin a person. Like, I say that in scare quotes, like, ruin a person's life. I mean, they're doing fucked up things, like, you know, that's somebody, other people's lives have been, you know, harmed by this, da-da-da. But if it sets that precedent, then the impact of that on, like, a poor person of color who engaged in abusive behavior is a lot harder to cope with, and doesn't make a society that is full of less abusers. It makes a society that punishes abusers. And so I struggle with that. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it would be
great. We've talked about it before. Yeah. I get it. I get it.
I think it would be great to have a journalist on to talk about, like maybe a journalist who have different perspectives on it. Feminist journalists who are part of sort of like, who think that strategy is important, and feminists who don't. So yeah, to be continued. Would love to know listeners' thoughts.
Yes, please. On our Facebook group, Twitter, Instagram, you just let us know. Email.
Yeah. So
we read them all.
Briefly, we want to shout out, defend, support Minnesota's own Ilhan Omar, who was getting dragged for making a comment about AIPAC. Mel, do you want to give the rundown of this one?
Yeah, of course. So for our international listeners or national listeners that aren't familiar with that, AIPAC is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And she's Muslim, and she has for a very, very, very long time been pro-Palestinian. And she had put out a couple tweets last week about basically making commentary on how that group, AIPAC, is using money to persuade other politicians to vote pro-Israel policy when those things come up in our government. And so she had tweets saying it's all about the Benjamins as one response. And then another one, somebody had asked, would love to know who Ilhan thinks is paying American politicians to be pro-Israel. And then she responded, AIPAC. Like, she tweeted that out. So she's very upfront about it. So those are the tweets. Mm-hmm. Knowing her politics, that's not surprising. She got creamed in the media. Like, people, I don't know how many people were furious, because there's this, like, fake majority that kind of comes out through the news. But, like, there was so much press about this. Do you want to explain, like, why people were upset?
Yeah.
We don't agree.
Right. Well, as usual, any criticism of Israel is often seen as being anti-Semitic. And so, unfortunately, like, what this misses is that there's a difference between, like, being anti-Jewish people and being anti the state of Israel and anti-Zionism for the way that it violences, displaces, and represses Palestinian people. So that's her critique, and it doesn't mean she's anti-Jewish people. And even, no, yeah, wait. So yeah, go ahead.
I just want to jump in with an anecdote about that. I had a really long talk with my friend Emily, who lives out in Portland, about this, because she's Jewish. And I just asked her a ton, not about this specifically, but about Jewishness and Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And she was explaining to me that, like, there is a ton, I don't want to say that she said the majority, but, like, a lot of Jewish people in this country don't agree with what's going on in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's some weird fucked up perception that is coming down from conservatives in this country, that if you say anything that is against Israel, like you said, Rachel, it is anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish, which is just bullshit because there's actual Jewish people in this country that are not pro-Israel. They don't agree with the what's going on there. So the point being, like, the criticism she's getting is completely unfair and way out of left field.
Yeah, and also not...
I think it's coming from a small percentage of people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think the way that I think that a lot of people aren't informed about the Israeli-Palestine conflict, and I think that it's very hammered home in the U.S. that we are not supposed to be prejudiced against Jewish people. Like, we have public memory of World War II in
totally.
Our consciousness.
Yeah.
We were the good guys in that. Like, we don't have that same narrative around Palestine. And so I think if anybody hears, like, oh, this Muslim woman is talking bad things about Israel, that a lot of people actually do think that that means, oh, she's being bigoted against Jewish people.
Sure.
So I think that unfortunately it is probably a larger amount of people just based on, like, sort of sheer ignorance. Yeah. So I think unfortunately it's probably quite a few people, including, this was probably like the worst part of this whole fiasco. Like, not the worst, that's a lie. Like, her having to deal with bullshit is the worst part. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, because basically Elon posted kind of a clarification, kind of apology, even though I don't think she had any reason to apologize. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and they're kind of buds, they're like, you know, part of the sort of like new feminist, you know, women of color in Congress. She posted as a follow-up, like, unlike our president, Elon was able to grow and learn from her comment and apologized. And, like, basically she didn't defend her comment. She said, look at how good it is that she was able to, like, learn and grow from this criticism because she said something that was not okay. That's kind of what the implication was. And that really bothered me. I still like her a lot. I still like her a lot.
So I was thinking about this too with Ilhan Omar. How much of this is them and how much of this is like PR that their staff is making them do?
I think that's a fair point. That's a fair point.
For their larger...
And that, I think you're probably right. And that's why, like, never in a trillion years could I be involved with mainstream politics, because I just, like, could not stomach having to say... Because you're right. I bet Elon didn't want to apologize. I bet she knows she said
nothing
wrong.
Oh, not at all.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's a good point. And same with AOC.
She didn't say anything wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I can't even... And I will say... There, listeners can pay attention to this too, or you should be paying attention to this, how much bullshit that AOC and Ilhan Omar are going through in the media, and like how much criticism they're getting from their fellow congresspeople. It's just, it's baffling. There was a CNN reporter who tried to get a comment from her about these tweets, tried to get a quote from Ilhan about these tweets. And she said to him, are you serious right now? And after she said that to him, he framed it as her yelling at her.
Oh my God.
Or yelling at him.
Yeah.
And she was not yelling.
Right.
Like, if you, because she had this really interesting exchange with a warmonger, basically, in Congress this week. And she just talks very calmly.
Yeah.
But everybody wants, all the people that don't like her just want to say that she's yelling and being, but she's not. I mean, she's brilliant, like, in her strategy.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's the angry black woman thing again, yelling.
Mm-hmm.
She was not yelling.
Yes.
Mainstream corporate media is, please do not watch it to get your news. Please consume something else. It's just garbage. Ready to rant some more?
Sure.
Let's keep it going.
All right. We are going to try to connect some threads, but we want to ground it in two things that have been sort of discussed a lot in the past few weeks/month. Ariana Grande released a video where she was looking bronzer than even she has been in the past year, which, in addition to other things that she's been doing, has sort of unleashed a lot of discussion about the notion of blackfishing, which we'll talk about in a moment. And then J-Lo performed at the Grammys for Motown Records, sort of a medley, sort of in honor of them, for an event that's coming up with them?
It was a cross promotion for an actual Motown concert with actual Motown performers from that era. That's going to air on CBS on April 21st.
Yeah. Yes. And people were not thrilled that a non-Black person was doing that, given how many Black musicians there are that could have done that, and that the Grammys decided to give that opportunity to J-Lo. That also brought up articles that talked about cultural appropriation. So we want to dig into this. We've talked about cultural appropriation before. I also, as always, want to say when we're talking about things that impact people of color, obvious note, Melody and I are white women. We have degrees in critical media studies, so that is the lens we are approaching it from. We have a background in critical race theory, so that is the lens we are approaching it from. We also want to amplify Black journalists that have written about this, so we'll be quoting them throughout the discussion. So that's a side note. As always, you know, we invite people to listen to analysis about this kind of stuff from people of color as well, so or exclusively. So Mel, you go ahead and you start.
So the performance was, as we said, a medley. And she always had backup dancers that were either all women or all men. And at the beginning of the performance, she had on a very long dress with a lot of feathers on the sleeves and at the bottom of her dress, which was very Motown fashion inspired. And it was a very, you know, very cute. I shouldn't say cute. I don't want to infantilize her, but just a very well done Motown performance. And then like halfway through the performance, she takes off that outfit and then is in a bodysuit, like a Beyonce bodysuit, basically, and with high boots on, and gets a little bit more J-Lo, if you will. So a little bit more sexy. And the performance itself, I guess, wasn't the problem. I think it was more about like what her performing it represented and all of her backup dancers. There was only a few obviously Black dancers there. It was a very mixed race situation. And I know a lot of the critique has been on her, like, what is her role or what is her right to perform this. I personally did not love the sexualization of Motown at that point. And the only reason that I want to say that is because Motown music was really, really, really important to African Americans, and that style of, like, it wasn't a sexualized genre of music. Obviously the people were very sexy, but not in the way that J-Lo kind of sexualized it. Not to say that is not okay for her to sexualize or be sexual on stage. It was just a weird tension with that genre because it was from the 60s. And also, I want to say something more specifically about the Grammys and why, and I'm actually going to kind of defend J-Lo for a moment here. Almost all of the music performances had this weird intersectionality going on. So I'm too old to know who sings that Havana song. Who sings that? Rachel, do you know?
I know the song. I don't Havana, know. Na, 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 na. I don't know who sings that song. Havana, Havana, Havana,
Havana. Na, na. Okay, whoever sings that, we're too old to know. That was the opener for the Grammys, and it was a really interesting mix of Latin culture and American culture. And so they had a lot of Latin American artists come up and perform and like add. There was like a hip hop and rapper guy who came on and did his thing. And so, and then with Red Hot Chili Peppers, who somebody else performed. I'm like, did not do my homework. What I want to say is that in almost all of the performances, there was a blending of genres. And so this performance also would apply the blending of J-Lo, like this new school pop singer with Latin American and Bronx roots, with Motown was like another attempt at blending those genres. But that's not how it got taken up by people who were watching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I think in the context of the Grammys performances, it made a ton of sense. I think on the Grammy producers' side of things, there was a lot of ignorance in casting J-Lo to do that performance. And they really should know at this point with how much backlash there has been about African-American culture not being honored in the media industries.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's my first take at it.
I think that's really good clarification. It's really good to have more of that information or to think about that in the context of the whole show. And I think you're right. It probably was not a good decision, but perhaps that is sort of what they were thinking about. This notion of genre is interesting. There's an article from Meredith Che, who's a Black writer, a Black woman, who was specifically, she said she thought ultimately more disturbed about the sort of genre, the fact that J-Lo isn't a soul singer, than she was about J-Lo being Latina. So she says, quote, "I'm more aware that my anxieties from Sunday night's tribute are rooted more deeply in the lack of appropriate musical representation than race representation, which brings me to my questions. Were soul artists offered to take a part in the tribute? If so, did they reject the offer? What decision-making model was used to make the choice?" And I appreciate that a lot, because I think it makes it about who's getting jobs. Like, it makes it about economics. Representation is ultimately, for me, hashtag Marxist, things do feel very importantly sometimes boiled down to, like, follow the money, who's getting jobs, who's getting paid. And so I appreciate that sort of, like, we can use Meredith Che's comment to think about, you know, ultimately this becomes a question of, you know, who got that opportunity, and it wasn't a black, at the end of the day, it wasn't a black person, and it wasn't a black person who actually, you know, it wasn't a musician who actually sings in that style. So that's something to think about, because if we sort of just back up and sort of, if we think about cultural appropriation, it's defined as the adoption of elements of one culture by members of another culture. This can be controversial when members of a dominant culture appropriate from a disadvantaged minority culture. J-Lo is not a white woman, and so ultimately, even though it still sort of falls under the definition of appropriation, she isn't part of the dominant culture in terms of race. However, there is still this notion that a Latina woman wouldn't be able to sort of, that there is something problematic about a Latina woman performing what is traditionally understood as, quote, black music. And so the other step back that I want to do is that anytime cultural appropriation conversations come up, I struggle a little bit, because they are ultimately rooted in essentialist understandings of race and culture. I think we can definitively say that Motown is part of black culture because of the material conditions that Motown came about in Detroit, you know, sort of as a result of the whiteness of the music industry. However, I think it gets complicated when we essentialize things without those material aspects. Like, rap, we can also say, is part of black culture because of those material conditions that rap emerged from. Like, rap is basically a form of protest against, you know, brutality that the black communities, mm-hmm. Black men in particular, who sort of were creating the genre, experienced. But it's not because that particular style of music is, like, it's not because, like, putting words together really fast is like a black thing to do. It's because of these material conditions that it becomes linked to blackness. I don't think most people talk about it in that way, though. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yep. And just to piggyback off what you just said about rap and hip hop, is that I love that phrasing of the material conditions, because part of the reason rap emerged is the black community was trying to find a style of music that white people couldn't cover, because that's how they got ostracized from, or they just, in rock and roll, in the early rock and roll, black mm-hmm, musicians mm-hmm. were covered all the time. Their songs were covered, but then they never got money for it, right? And Little Richard and some other black artists, James Brown, they started writing lyrics mm-hmm. that, like, white people literally couldn't sing.
Right.
White people would try to change them, but, like, rap was that, like, an extreme extension of that. It's like, right. Okay, well, you can't cover N.W.A. Like, you can't try to match N.W.A., right? So I agree with you, but I also wonder, too, if, like, if it is a black thing, because, like, the genre was created to then not be covered by white people. But also, I think it's a marginalized person's thing. I don't know. This is, like, fascinating discussion that we've gotten ourselves into. Well, it is not a black thing. I can, as a white lady, I'm
right. And there's, you know, black writers that have said both of those things, you know, in various ways as well. I totally appreciate that history, and I think that's super interesting. I didn't know that, or, you know, think about that or realize that specifically about rap, but that makes total sense.
I think with the cultural appropriation thing, and then all the things that you were just saying about just essentializing race, is that because J-Lo is Latinx, this is a different conversation then, because she is part of a marginalized community demographic.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about a white person, and she didn't appropriate it. Like, she was giving a tribute to Motown. Like, I think it was I didn't agree with how she gave the tribute in some aspects, but it wasn't like she came out with a Motown album.
Yeah.
You know, like, it just doesn't feel appropriate-y to me, both in, like, how she did it, and then also because of her positionality in the world as a brown person. But I also hear they didn't get, but black people also, a black woman did not get paid for that. Then,
yeah, I think,
you know, but then it's like, then it becomes this essentializing thing where it's like, historically, yes, I understand why a black woman should be paid for a Motown tribute, but are we going to, do we say that then for everything?
Right. Well, that to me becomes where we bring like material conditions of history into it. And like it, Motown wasn't full of Latina people, Latinx people. It was, you know, it was being performed and produced by black people. So that's how we can sort of say, maybe this is what would be best, a better honor in that regard. Especially because, you know, I mean, as always, we can't say black people thought this about it, because that is also incredibly essentializing and fucked up. I will say, like, there were, in fact, Smokey Robinson in particular was defending J-Lo, and he was saying, like, this is silly. She did a great job honoring, and we shouldn't be, you know, that this music is for everybody. But, you know, I was seeing lots of articles that were screenshotting, like, parts of Black Twitter that were basically like, no, this is not okay. So we're, you know, we're amplifying both of those perspectives and trying to bring in some of this, you know, broader conversation about what we define as sort of essentializing, which is sort of making a monolith of a race or a culture, sometimes in an effort to defend and protect that culture, but also can be really problematic. Is that sort of a good, do we have more to say about that? Or is that maybe a good transition into just sort of briefly bringing in how Ariana fits into this as well?
Transition.
So this feels particularly different. Like, this feels unique from J-Lo, certainly because Ariana Grande is a white person. I will say, so she is Italian, and there's articles going around and, you know, social media in general and people talking about the way that what they're calling blackfishing, which is sort of described as this process of taking on what is associated with black aesthetic and culture, and that includes things like literally darkening your skin, using African-American vernacular English, the boxer braids. Other people you can think about being accused of this are the Kardashians, Iggy Azalea, Miley Cyrus when she was in her phase of, you know, trying to be like a rapper or whatever. So Miley never darkened her skin. So that's something a little different that's happening. But there's also a ton of social media influencers who I don't know, because I just don't know that world as well, but who are sort of being accused of this as well. There's a Swedish woman who is like many, many shades darker. Oh, and also most famously, perhaps Rachel Dolezal, who genuinely said she was a black woman when she actually is not a black woman, and darkened her skin and got sort of did her hair in what is traditionally black styles. So with Ariana, I think one of the first things to note, first of all, I want to shout out LaCrista Greco, who runs Guerrilla Feminism, who's a friend of the show. She has always had a lot of, I think, smart stuff to say about this, because she's really rooted to her Italian culture. And she, Ariana Grande, is Italian. And so there's this great post that I think she probably screenshotted on her Instagram. I know it was on her Facebook, giving the sort of history of the construction of Italians as white, which wasn't always the case. So I do think that's an important thing to bring in, because Italians and Irish immigrants were not always considered white. And there's a book called How the Irish Became White. There's books also about, similarly, about Italians being treated as non-white and then gaining access to whiteness. So I do think that's worth mentioning, that Italian heritage has a unique and tenuous relationship to the construct of whiteness, which is how we sort of talk about it in academic spheres, which is this notion that that sort of the powers that be socially construct a race, whiteness in particular, to be a thing that is, first of all, real. One of my favorite academic quotes is Thomas Nakayama, who writes about whiteness, says that race is a very real fiction. So race is fake, right? Like, there's literally nothing different between anybody of any color, sort of biologically, even though science was used to say that there was differences, which is all completely fake. However, it operates in incredibly real ways. And so this sort of fake construction of whiteness enabled slavery, all the forms of bigotry that racism, you know, that sort of white supremacy, the conditions that it creates and that built the country, right? So that's sort of a side note. I don't think Ariana Grande is trying to, like, remind people of the oppressed roots of Italian Americans when she's doing this kind of stuff. There are people who defend her, people who say this is totally not okay. There's an article by Cecily Brown that I'll link in the newsletter for folks who are interested, where she's defending Ariana. I would like to read that quote, actually, because it's really good, but I'm going to pause because I just talked for a while. So what are your initial sort of thoughts on this?
I mean, to be honest, I thought she was mixed race. And I was just thinking about how fucked up it is that this is just white supremacy in action, that we both demand that we stay on top, but also steal from other cultures to maintain our dominance. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, so you're going to disrespect and not bring up people, like lift up people that are brown and black, but you're going to steal from this culture and use it to sell records because being white is too boring. It's not enough to get you in the pop world. And it's true because hip hop and Latin American music is like the number one. Those are the number one genres in America right now.
Right.
And so being a white girl is boring. Being a white girl is boring in the music industry right now. Too bad. So sad. That doesn't mean that you get to like look brown to like, you know, to pass. And I mean, Ariana Grande is fine. Like, she seems to be like empowering young girls and, you know, nothing against her as a person or whatever. This is just more of like a statement that she's representing this like larger system.
I think that's an important point. Like, we always need to like know that record industry, like, go see A Star Is Born. You'll see how much control record labels have over their, you know, the people that they own, right? That they manage. So, you know, we don't know what choices she's making personally. So, yes. And I want to go back to this Cecily Brown quote. So Cecily Brown's a black writer who writes, quote, aesthetically, but she's defending Ariana. So this is a little bit of a switch, but I think the beginning of this is important, regardless of what sort of side you fall on it. Aesthetically, racial ambiguity has always been preferred over the assumed neutrality of whiteness and the assumed undesirability of blackness. The Kardashians have mastered the art of blurring the lines of their own racial identity to do everything from sell hair extensions to black women and butt-lifting jeans to white women. This kind of skin alteration has made headlines recently, with a slew of Instagram influencers being accused of blackfishing or portraying themselves as black for financial and social gain on the platform. There is a dialogue that needs to be had about racial exoticism as a beauty technique, one that Grande's glam team probably needs to be a part of, but blackface it is not. So she's giving, I think, some really important context that says why this is fucked up. At her bottom line is like, actually, but it's not blackface, and like, so it's not as egregious, and like, it needs to be a conversation, but it's not the same as the sort of historical blackface that we think about. But Mel, going back to, so with that and the thing that you said, you know, like, you can't have it both ways. Just to sort of make that even more concise, like, the way that Ariana Grande and the I don't know if Kardashians are being accused of using African-American vernacular English, but these, even just aesthetically, that kind of shit can get you, like, that's the kind of shit that gets you over-policed and arrested in low-income communities of color, right? Like, if you are talking, quote-unquote, black, like, African-American vernacular English is what we mean when people say that, that's grounds for, like, the cops being suspicious of you and, like, arresting you if you're not, like, a famous superstar who has a shit ton of money, right? So that's sort of, like, the bottom line of this is, like, that these behaviors aren't valued unless they're in very particular forms. And in the case of the Kardashians and Ariana Grande, it's what I'm going to say, sort of white women, barring that Italians were not always socially constructed as white. And also, interestingly, the panel at Whitman that I was on, there's this really incredible researcher who's doing work on the Armenian genocide and the construction of whiteness of Armenian people. And the Kardashians are Armenian. And that's not always super clear. Are technically, as a category on the U.S. Census, they were changed. Armenian was changed to white, but that wasn't always the case either. So that's also really interesting, I think, when we think about the Kardashians and whiteness. But they clearly have access to whiteness in ways that other POC who don't have a gazillion dollars do not. So all of these things are operating together.
I would also like to mention that Ariana Grande also likes to hang out with dudes that are white, that have tattoos and like have that like hip hop aesthetic, but get a bunch of privilege because they're white men. So I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but I think like Pete Davidson is a good example of that. Do you know, are you aware of his look?
I know. Yeah, no,
Yes, to your point, yeah. that like those people, yeah. Like if Pete Davidson is going out and about, like he's not going to get pulled over because he's a white guy, you right. know, but he's got the right. all he's got the slang, he's got the look, he's got the drugs, yeah. you know, but he's not going
right.
to. So it's just like, it just.
No, I know it. I know it.
Extend
know
that
it.
Example. It's not just her. It's like the people that she hangs out with, too.
Yeah. I was also thinking when I was thinking about other people who've sort of been accused of either appropriation or blackfishing. Just like thinking about it kind of makes my stomach turn that I like liked that Miley album so much because that was like also her phase where she was just so obsessed with pot and like smoking and being a stoner. And that was before I think any state had decriminalized it entirely, which just like makes me sick yeah. to my stomach to think about like her. And I'm sure we, you know, I think I knew that, but I also just like am a little grossed out of myself for like letting myself like some of those songs on that album. So yeah, because the drug war in particular, like if you're gonna, if part of this sort of whole notion of blackfishing is like mirroring sort of stoner culture in the sort of like party stoner way that some people like racialize, I just can't, because thinking about all the people who are rotting in prison right now, I just don't
get us start. That's a whole other 20 that's minutes of yelling thing. Because yeah. that's
Yeah.
That's white it's supremacy so right there. That's
Yep, for sure, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think that covers like a lot of questions that come up in this. Again, we're not certainly as white women going to tell you who was right and who was wrong at all. We just I think wanted to bring up some of the sort of theories that it evokes for us to try to make better sense of it or like put it into more historical context. And so, I'll link to these other writers and you know, you can obviously have your own thoughts, but should we move on to our final segment of the day?
Is that RWL, Rachel?
Reading, watching, and listening. With Rachel and Melody.
Such a good jingle.
Mm-hmm. I love our Emily Jane Powers musical instrumental version that y'all just heard after we edit as well, but I kind of like that we do yeah, both every time.
I agree.
All right, what are you reading, watching, listening to?
I'm reading a book called Quiet. It's about introversion and how it's really interesting. It's not like a self-help book. It's more of like how extroversion is just like the preferred way of being in this country and how, like, for example, teaching like the quiet person in class, like, well, they're not contributing anything because they're not talking out loud. Right. But
right,
they might
right.
be yep. writing amazing notes. You know how it is, you know, but that's just like a really yeah. quick example.
Right.
So I'm yep. reading that and I'm enjoying it. Is it cheating to say that like I'm watching a bunch of Grammy performances?
Okay. No.
I watched the J-Lo performance like 3 times last week with my students. And cool. and the Oscar. When are the Oscars? Sorry.
This coming weekend.
Oh,
this,
my gosh.
A week from today. Well, we record on Sunday, so it's a week from today.
It's Rachel's favorite holiday, y'all.
I do like it a lot. It gets harder and harder to love it, but I'll never not love it.
I'm listening to Laserbeak's new album called Luther. He's part of the Doomtree Collective out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. But you would actually really like it, Rachel. It's good studying music or good working music. It's got a little it's instrumental. It's pretty ambient with my accent here. But it's got like a little like pop to it, like a little energy to it. So I've been really liking Rad. That. Yep.
Cool. Great.
Yeah.
So I just started the book Heartberries, a memoir by Therese Marie Mailhot. I'm not totally sure how to say her last name. I've definitely in memoir mode since my manuscript is due at the end of March. So kind of all I want to put in my brain other than necessary work things is memoir. And this is written by a Native American woman, and it's really fucking beautiful writing. She's basically, it's literally like ultimately like an edited version of the journals that she wrote when she was in a mental institution, and weaves in sort of reflection on her childhood trauma, also like a really sort of destructive romantic relationship that is really just honestly, like it's just written in such like a raw and honest way. So it's very beautiful. I'm enjoying it. Even though it's difficult. And watching, I talked about Russian Doll last episode and I was on the fence about it. I just want to say that I finished it and really love it. So let's I hope I'm still, I can, I still say that you should watch it, Mel.
No, I'll watch it. I was waiting on your review. Okay.
Loved it. But as for a new thing that I'm watching, something different. Have I talked about Schitt's Creek on here? I think I have. I did. I know that I did. I thought that I did. Maybe I did.
What is
Regardless,
it about?
It's a comedy on Netflix. It's not the same. It's not Christopher Guest, who's the person who did Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show and all those, but it feels a lot like Christopher Guest, partly because there's some of the same cast members in Schitt's Creek, but it's very funny and really good if you just want to, like, if you really just want to sort of, like, check out and laugh. It's very funny. I really, really like it. It's about rich people who didn't realize that they were involved in, like, all these, like, fraudulent, you know, money laundering, like, just they basically lose all of their money. And the only thing that the IRS or whoever it is leaves them is this town they bought as a joke because it had the same name as their son, or something like that. And so they have to move to this, like, very poor rural town and, like, learn to, like, live there. And it's just, you know, and all the hijinks that ensue. It's very funny. And there's a pansexual character, which I love very much, and it's good. Oh, and listening to, so after the, I love Phoebe Bridgers, have loved her for a while. She was one of the people who spoke and commented about her experience, her negative experience with Ryan Adams. I would definitely recommend listening to Phoebe Bridgers' solo album, but Melody, do you know that she's also on a project with Connor Oberst that is beautiful?
Yeah, you told me.
Oh, that's right. I texted.
You told me about it. I got to put it. Yeah. Is it part of his new project, or is it just a one-off single?
It's called Better Oblivion Community Center.
Okay. Yep. That's the new project he has. Okay, I'll look it up.
It's really good. I really like the whole album. So support women musicians and non-binary and trans. And
you don't think – so Connor's probably a decent guy because she wouldn't have gone
– I hope so. I mean, God, I'm sure he was an asshole. Like, you know, I'm sure he was
in his heyday.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. I think there's. I think it's important to talk about the difference between, like, being an asshole in a relationship and, like, making bad decisions that hurt people, which I definitely have done and definitely had done to me.
Yeah,
and
same.
Like abuse. So, like, that's important. So, I'm guessing he was shitty to a lot of women. Like, I kind of have no doubt.
Yeah,
but I think that is substantially different.
Yes.
So, anyway. FKJ.
Power.
Bye. Us on the interweb and how you can support us. So you can always subscribe to us on your favorite podcast application, and of course you get extra FKJ points if you leave us a review on iTunes. It is a wonderful way to spread the word and gain new followers, and we really appreciate it. On the social media tip, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can like our Facebook page, and you can also join our closed community page, Feminist Killjoys Community-WTF Power. We have a Spotify mixtape that you can search out, Feminist Killjoys PhD Mixtape. And if you want to support us financially and you have some extra dollars, you could donate to our Patreon, or as a one-time thing on our website, just click on the birdie to make a one-time PayPal donation. Patreon donors also get access to the Killjoy Review newsletter. And of course, you can always email us at fkj.phd@gmail.com. And finally, you can leave us a voicemail at 414-858-7818. Again, 414-858-7818.